When Captain John Smith and other Englishmen arrived in Jamestown, Virginia, in April of 1607, they established the first permanent English settlement in America. But those who came were already worldly men, some of whom had traveled to the ends of the earth. Some had gone to Ireland, some to the Caribbean, others to West Africa and South America, still others to Muscovy and Cathay. The English world at the time really was a world in motion, and Jamestown could be described as a dot on the map in a global pattern of movement. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is New Perspectives on Jamestown. Jamestown was an English venture, but there were also people from all over Europe who were brought there to be part of the colony. Surprisingly, England and Poland at that time were closely connected, with as many as 30,000 English, Scots, and Irish living and working in Poland. And at the time of the Jamestown settlement, there were as many as 1,000 Poles living in London, which even had a street named Poland Street. Today we'll learn the Polish workers made unique contributions to the Jamestown experience. With me are three historians, Patrick Griffin from the University of Virginia, James Horn from William & Mary, and John Radzilowski from the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Jim, let me start with you. I'm surprised to hear that even by the second year of Jamestown, 1608, a variety of nationalities was represented among the settlers. Clearly, Jamestown was an overwhelmingly British endeavor. But, Jim, what other nationalities were represented?
There were several Poles, Germans, people from the Swiss area. There might have been French. And, of course, later on, there were also, by 1619, there were Africans.
John Radzilowski, was there a strong trade relationship between Poland and England during the late 1500s, early 1600s?
Yes, there certainly was. Coming out of the Baltic, it was a grain trade, trade in wood products, primarily coming out of the city of Gdańsk with London.
That this is a moment, too, where England is looking to trade with anybody and everybody around the world. You have explorers who are going to Persia, to Russia, to West Africa, to the Spanish Main, literally to the ends of the earth to try to find, to set up trading relationships with whomever they possibly can.
The best way of thinking about Jamestown is it's not as an isolated colony on the far fringes of the English-speaking world, but as a place that's connected through England to a much broader Atlantic economy that the English are developing at this time.
We tend to think of the 21st century as the global century, but in fact it's this late 16th, early 17th century is the first real global period that you can speak of, and Jamestown is part and parcel of this global movement at the time. And as I said, you have people who are moving to every end of the earth to try to find any commodity they possibly can exploit, raise, whatever it's going to be, something merchantable. And Jamestown is part and parcel of that. So if you're looking at the Baltic for your wood products, and you try to find another way that you can possibly get them on your own ground. And so Jamestown is part of that movement.
Was it unusual for the Virginia Company to have sought out foreigners? Why not all British people?
Well, it wasn't unusual at all, and the reason for that was they were trying to set up a number of industries in Virginia, and they went to those countries that produced the best workers in those particular industries. So they were looking for people to produce wine from France. The Poles would be responsible for pitch and tar production. There would be German miners. So they were trying to find the real specialists of the day who could produce these goods in Virginia.
Surely there were perfectly competent English glassmakers and soapmakers.
You'd be surprised, but they really weren't. The English had a lot of skill when it came to making wool. But beyond that, some of these other skills they frankly didn't have at the time. And so they had to look abroad for some of these people. And so they're going to Italy for glass blowers. They're going to France for people who can work with wine and work with vines. They're looking for people who have some expertise perhaps in silk. And they're going to Poland to try to find people who have some experience with pitch, boiling pitch.
What is pitch and why was that such an important craft to be made in the New World?
Well, pitch was what sort of the universal glue of the era. It sealed up everything from ships to casks to use it on your house or wherever you needed something sealed up.
Arguably, pitch made the world go round in lots of ways because pitch is a wood product, and this is a world that runs on wood, and it's these kinds of products, pitch, tar, turpentine, and of course wood for masts and planking and things like that, which are vital to this world.
I'm captivated that they drew from so far afield for some of these craftspeople. For instance, there were craftsmen from Poland, as you mentioned. How many Poles in Jamestown?
There were about eight Poles and Germans that arrived in October of 1608. And there may have been a half a dozen or more subsequently in the next few years, probably in the order of a dozen or so, maybe two dozen at most, would have come in before 1620.
And how did they come to the colony? Had they been living in London when they were recruited?
Some of them may have been recruited through London, but England had trade links to the Baltic, to Gdańsk, and to areas of Poland, and that was also an area John Smith knew very well. So they would have been familiar with craftsmen from those areas.
And what specific specialties do you think they wanted most from the Poles?
Well, certainly making pitch, tar, soap ash, any kind of forest product to build the colony and also to build ships. You know, if you think of pitch as the super glue of the era, it's used in everything, so it's certainly needed.
Did they make any ships at Jamestown?
Well, they would have repaired them, of course.
I don't know if they had hopes and dreams of making ships, but they certainly planned on deforesting the place and sending back as much timber as they possibly could as quickly as they could. And this gets to the Polish issue, too, because, I mean, it was the Baltic region where they went for naval stores over and over again. And they wanted to find another place, that the place that they were going to have a colony, where they could find these kinds of commodities. And so Jamestown figures largely in that. Even though they wanted to raise things like silk and fine gold as quickly as they possibly could.
It's as if you have to think trees. Because in England, by the late 16th, early 17th century, there is a shortage of timber. Whereas when the first English arrived in the Chesapeake, one of the things that really struck them was the enormous variety and the abundance of trees. As they approached the shore, all they could see was this forest stretching away into the distance. It's a form of wealth that we might not appreciate today, but certainly from their point of view, it was a bonanza to find all this timber available to them.
As a matter of fact, the first thing they often said when they were coming over to the New World was actually the first thing they smelled, and that was the trees. Before they even saw the New World, the first thing they noticed was the smell of all these wonderful trees. Ships were like the airliners of the day, and so wood products were more or less like oil is to us today. This is something that's a very important product and something that people are going to go searching hither and yon in order to find.
And they were in need of constant repair. A trip across the Atlantic is very damaging to these ships, and every time they come back and forth, they're going to need to be repaired and fixed up for your next journey, just like any aircraft maintenance would do when the aircraft lands at the airport.
Let's talk about the role of the Poles in the Society of Jamestown. Apparently, they were rather politically assertive, confident in their rights. How did they understand their role in the colony?
They may not have had their Lech Walesa at the time, but they were certainly more than willing to stand up for their rights as workers and as men from time to time.
They were quite conscious of their skills working in those industries that we've talked about, and they saw themselves as specialist workers and therefore having a special status within the colony. In July of 1619, they were not permitted to vote for the first elected government in Virginia, and they petitioned the court for their right to take part in that election.
They staged some sort of protest, apparently putting down their tools and issuing some sort of memorandum, perhaps. But the other thing, I think, with the Poles is that they came from a place where there was limited government, and they had a sense of their own rights. And obviously, if they weren't being allowed to vote, they felt denied.
I think very clearly they didn't feel they should be excluded because of their nationality. They felt they were contributing just as much to the colony as the English and therefore should take part in the electoral process.
And that said, too, labor unrest wasn't unknown in this place. For example, Smith is calling the Germans there these damn Dutchmen who just won't listen to anything he wants to do and are running away and joining the Indians and things like this. So this wasn't completely unusual for the time.
It's so interesting to me in listening to this that the Polish workers were bold enough to actually have some kind of work stoppage or to protest. Were they well regarded? Because evidently the English, very soon after the protest, did grant them the voting right.
Yeah, I think they were well regarded. And actually there were efforts in the 1620s to make sure that younger men were to learn the skills of these Polish workers so that those skills wouldn't die with the Poles themselves. So I think they were certainly well respected for their trades.
And Smith certainly knew the Poles very well. He had traveled through Poland and had high regard for them.
What was his connection with Poles or having traveled in Poland? What was his mission? This was before Jamestown.
This was before Jamestown. In the years before Jamestown, eastern Poland, eastern Hungary, a bit like the Wild West, a lot of adventurers, soldiers of fortune, and Smith was certainly among those. He served in a military campaign in what is today Romania.
This guy is the epitome of a swashbuckler when you think about it. I mean, he's leaving his home and he comes from a middling sort of family, not particularly well educated, but he does have some education. He heads over to the Netherlands where he's going to fight the Catholic Spanish. And after that, he decides he's sick of seeing Christian killing Christian, as he puts it. So he heads over then to join the Austrian army and he's going to fight the Turks. And then he's captured. Then he escapes. Then he decides to travel around places like Russia and Poland, parts of Eastern Europe, and then North Africa, then over to England. And then finally, at the age of 27, you think about that age, how young he is for having had those experiences, he finds himself over in Jamestown. So he was really an extraordinary sort of person, giving the typical sort of colonist that you're going to find in Jamestown early on.
Do you believe everything he writes about himself like this?
No.
Well, the stories of him being rescued, repeatedly rescued by beautiful exotic maidens, might be stretching the limits of imagination. And of course, Smith is writing this as an older man. He's writing it for an audience that's hungry for adventure stories. But even if half of it were true, it's an extraordinary life.
In Smith's world, he always does right and knows right, and everybody else is wrong.
He kind of dresses it up and he emphasizes his own role in it, but I think he's a reliable source. He's a reliable author.
In his writings, does he refer to coming to know or fight alongside Poles?
He doesn't specifically do that, but he certainly would have served alongside Poles who were doing the same thing that he was doing, being a soldier of fortune. There were Polish officers all over Eastern Europe fighting in many of the armies. He would have met many of them, stayed at their houses as well.
I'd like to come back to a particular story as to why Smith might have been very grateful to a couple of Poles, particular Poles. And this event took place in the spring of 1609. Smith is about a mile from the fort down by the glass house that had just been built maybe a few months before, where he's attacked by the chief of the Paspahes. And they fall into the river and they're struggling in the river. The Paspahe chief is dragging Smith under. And Smith's life is saved by two Poles that come along and drag him out and drag out the Indian chief who makes his escape and gets away. But it could well have been that Smith's Virginia adventure might well have ended there on the banks of the James River had it not been those couple of Poles that were passing by. He doesn't name them, but he must have been very grateful to them.
Jim, do we know the names of any of the Polish settlers in early Jamestown?
We know the name of one Pole who called himself Thomas Gates. He came to Virginia in 1609.
It's hard to think Thomas Gates is a Polish name.
More likely, the name, whatever his name was, has simply been anglicized into a form that English people could recognize.
But then again, we think of nationality. It's really something of a 19th and 20th century concept for the most part. These people, as they're coming over, have a much more fluid sense of who they are and what they can be than what we do today. And so it wouldn't be unusual for people of different ethnic groups to come over and to really reinvent themselves in a place such as Jamestown. Jamestown, if you think about it, is the perfect crucible where differences ultimately are melted down, because in a while, the most salient difference is going to be between white settlers and between Native Americans, and later on between white settlers and between blacks. So in many ways, this is the perfect place to forget that you're a German, you're a Pole, and then ultimately you just kind of become something else.
It's hard for me to believe that that's true, that people of this time had a more fluid sense of their identity than we do today.
Well, their loyalties were local. Their loyalties were to their families, often to their churches, and to their local communities. And nationality was a bit of an abstraction. It was something that a king or a nobleman might have taken a bit more seriously. But for the people at the time, their loyalties were the people that they lived with, their own families, their own compatriots.
To be English at the time didn't necessarily mean that one had to be born in England. It meant that one was going to buy into a certain sets of ideas about loyalty to the crown and, of course, about being Protestant. These were at the core of what it meant to be English at the time. These ideas, of course, change over time, but it's our modern conceptions, I think, which make us look back at the past with the idea that people are locked into certain kinds of hardened identities. And really, that's not the case at all.
And certainly if you were coming from England, you might think of yourself first as a Cornishman or a Londoner or even from a particular part of London. These were the areas that were familiar to you, the places you saw every day, rather than these people who lived in another part of England, who you never saw, who didn't even speak the same dialect you did, they would have been just as foreigners to you as someone from Poland.
And that's not to say that they would have said there's no difference at all. I would imagine this was one place where there were a lot of Polish jokes and German jokes and Irish jokes, every kind of joke you could possibly imagine, and they believed in every type of national stereotype one could possibly believe in. But at the same time, as I said, this was a place where one's identity could be melted down.
Well, those that didn't become English either left in the 1620s, a group of Italian glassblowers from Murano, Venice, went back to Italy, and a group of Germans went over to the Powhatans and probably met a pretty grisly fate at the hands of the Powhatans. The Poles, though, seem slightly different in this regard because they very clearly did want to be granted English rights, and that's what was behind the 1619 protest.
You know, we've talked a lot about glassmaking endeavors, the Italians, the Germans, perhaps the Poles. Why was that so important to the early Jamestown colonists?
Well, it was something they could trade with the Native Americans, of course, and in addition to that, a very useful product.
What did the Indians want of glass?
Well, specifically, they were interested in glass beads, and particularly a brilliant blue glass bead that they especially liked to use as trade and as a form of prestige goods, something that they'd gotten from the Europeans and could trade with other Indian groups.
And it was considered better to make your own in this glass factory rather than just simply bring barrels of glass beads over with you?
Well, that's relatively expensive to do. And the other thing is, of course, too, the Native Americans are discerning shoppers. These just aren't baubles, as far as they're concerned, they're little trinkets. These things are woven into status relationships that they have, and they're very important for maintaining order in their societies and for trade in their own society. So a manufacturer who knows what the Native American wants is going to ultimately be a manufacturer who's going to do very, very well in the trade.
And in addition to the beads, then, they were making items for their own consumption?
What they're producing are glass ingots, kind of chunks of glass that could be sent back to England and easily transported.
And how do you make glass?
You've got plenty of quartz sand that you're using. You heat that to a very high temperature in these ovens. That's what the glass house is. It's essentially a furnace where you can heat this sand to a very high temperature. You put in potash to help clarify the molten glass, and then you run it off into these ingots. So I think the key ingredient was the timber and the enormous amount of timber you needed to keep a furnace going.
The irony, of course, is none of this is going to get off the ground. They have these dreams about sending all this wood back to England, and they find out it's too expensive to ship it back. They can still get it more cheaply from other places. So after they have all these wonderful ideas, none of it's really going to pan out for the most part. And, of course, we know that this colony isn't going to be sustainable in any way, shape, or form until they fasten on tobacco. And so all of a sudden you found all these idle Englishmen who are literally, as one person put it, just bowling in the streets, kind of out of boredom. All of a sudden these streets now are planted with tobacco plants everywhere, and that would have been the one thing you would have noticed if you would have come into the 1620s, say, in Jamestown. There would have been tobacco everywhere.
It's certainly the growth of all the sin products that we think of today. Many of them begin to come from the New World, and Europeans develop a tremendous taste for tobacco, of course, but also for sugar, cocoa, and everything else that the New World can offer.
Virginia is a colony that from the get-go is set up to make money. It's headed up by some of the most influential merchants in London who've got connections all over the world. And what they're after are, on the one hand, grandiose plans of finding gold and silver mines, a passage to the South Sea. But on the other, they're trying to find profit in all sorts of rather more humble goods, natural produce of the land. And from the point of view of the establishment of tobacco, it is the first successful transatlantic crop from English colonies.
Oh, a lot of the members of the London Company of Virginia had these great ideas and great plans about the wonderful kind of exotic goods that were going to be defining the trade relationship. And some of them looked down like disparagingly at the Dutch, whose empire was based on contemptible fish and things like that. But ultimately, it's going to be contemptible tobacco and these kinds of products that are going to make Virginia actually run.
As you were saying very early on, Patrick, we tend to believe we're living in the first truly global culture and world. But how worldly were these Virginia Company men who conceived of settling Jamestown? And how worldly were the ones who first came here as captains of the ships and settlers and such?
In many ways, they're like our oil men today. I mean, these guys are tough, worldly adventurers who are looking to go out and to find and exploit whatever they possibly can to make a buck. That's, I think, the best way to think about these adventurers who come over early on. These are people who know about all ends of the earth. They've read or they've heard about all these wonderful, exotic kind of places. Many of them, like Smith, have traveled to these places. Many people, like the Poles and the Germans who are going to come over, these are people who had traveled to many other different kinds of places. So these aren't just kind of parochial people. They're not, in effect, like, quote-unquote, the first Americans, as we would think, and they're not wholly English, on the other hand. These are people who have been around the block.
And certainly for the case of a young craftsman coming over, this is a great opportunity. You're getting away from your the established craft guilds at home. You're able to make a new start and make your own products. You're not under the thumb of a guild or any kind of trade association as you would be in more established cities. So I think for a young person, mid-20s, with the skills to make glass or soap ash, this is a wonderful opportunity to make a name for yourself and, of course, make some money.
And their larger mental universe is shaped in different ways from ours. When we think about, like, when the kids today, like, they think about what adventure is going to be like out in space or something like that. For people of this age, it literally is kind of, what are things on the other side of the ocean like? And this ocean is not just the Atlantic, it's the Pacific as well. They're learning more and more about all these different kinds of places, and so kids are growing up dreaming about what life is like in China, in India, in South America. This is the adventurous stuff, and this is where adventurers of the day are drawn. But there's also, I think, we have to recognize the dark side of globalization. Like, today we're willing to talk about the darker aspects of it, and there was a darker aspect of it too in the 17th century, and Smith is a perfect example. When he comes over and encounters Native Americans at first, he will compare them to Muslims. And then when Native Americans are going to present problems to the early colonists, he's going to say, we have to resort to Irish tactics to deal with them. Terrorize the population. Deal with them as you would uncivilized kinds of heathens. So this was a world of dreams. This was a world of possibilities. But at the same time, it was a dark, very dark place too. Because sometimes the encounters that these adventurers had with other people around the world didn't always lead them to say, view Native Americans in the best light.
You mentioned a kind of global view, and there was a striking example for all English people in the early 17th century, and that was the example of Spain. In 1580, Spain absorbs Portugal, and we can talk about the first truly global empire coming into existence from that time onwards, from the 1580s onwards. There, this was an empire where the sun truly didn't set, from the East Indies all the way across to the Americas. So the English had this example of the power and the prosperity of Spain, the trade of Spain, on a truly global scale. And they too wanted to get their place in the sun and carve out their own empire.
And interestingly enough, they're left with all the places that the Spanish haven't taken. The Spanish at that point had taken all the good places, and so they're looking where they can set up shop in North America, but they can't get the nice rich places. They have to find these other kinds of regions and hope to make a go of it some way. But at first, they clearly want to get what the Spanish have. And, like, say, for example, you have English adventurers going to Baffin Island up in Canada, and they find gold, and they send the gold back in ships, and they find out it's actually fool's gold. And that was the kind of thing they were looking for. You know, who would want to set up shop in Baffin Island or Newfoundland? I mean, there's better places to be.
I think England's wealth is based on cheap and nasty goods, cheap goods that could be produced inexpensively and that could reach a broad market, and that is something that is quite different from the luxury trades of the earlier periods. Cheap and nasty really is the basis of the British Empire.
You know, in the popular mind, we associate Jamestown with many things, but among them are the importation of slaves, tobacco growth, of course, but also the knowledge that, you know, hundreds of these people who first arrived never lived to see any profit or return to England. Now that we are reflecting on 400 years since the birth of Jamestown, what are we to make of it?
Well, I think Jamestown has suffered a lot in comparison to another founding myth, which is New England's. And in contrast to Jamestown, which is associated with hardship and disease and starving time and so on, Plymouth is often associated with the first successful English colony, hardy, pioneering, God-fearing folk who severed relationships with England 150 years before the United States did. So Jamestown has not had good PR in comparison to Plymouth. But The importance of Jamestown is that the experimentation in how to set up a colony became applied to other colonies, including Plymouth, including Massachusetts.
And it certainly is a symbol of that global world that's emerging. And the fact that you have Poles and Germans, Africans, Native Americans meeting in this place does, in fact, symbolize something that the Americans of a later generation will look back on and remember as the first step in a larger global process.
The irony is that we tend to see Jamestown as kind of the site of America's 400th birthday. But as we're talking about today, in many ways, Jamestown is much more like our world today than we could really give it credit for at first. And when we just think about it in that parochial way as being something having to do with only America's birth, we miss all the stuff that's going to happen thereafter that is really going to be, I think, more defining for American character and identity.
Well, Patrick and John and Jim, thank you for talking with me today on New Perspectives on Jamestown.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Patrick Griffin is a professor of history at the University of Virginia. John Radzilovsky teaches history at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, Minnesota. James Horn is the director of the Rockefeller Library of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation and teaches history at the College of William and Mary. He's the author of a book on early Jamestown called A Land as God Made It. New Perspectives on Jamestown is a production of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and was produced with the generous support of the Rosenstiel Foundation. Elliot Majerzik and Jesse Dukes are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our features. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. For a free copy of this show on CD, or to comment, call 877-451-5098. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.